profit motive with the profit motive. P-R-O-P-H-E-T, P-R-O-F-I-T, right?
Right.
They want to be right. It's not about the money.
Right.
And in gamblers, that is a disease. There is something wrong there. It is a betting gone amok. Money is just a ticket to enter. They're there for the adrenaline rush. And I don't pretend to be an authority on, you know, what that is, but it's the other end of the spectrum, but it is one of the categories.
Mm-hmm.
But you can gamble in the securities markets,
sure,
in the commodities markets, in the currency markets, whatever. You don't have to be in a gambling casino to be gambling if you exhibit the behaviors. And then I go through what the behaviors are so people can start to recognize and acknowledge what they're up against. And then the last piece is, you know, what are the emotions of a group or individual? And again, I'm not talking about being a psychologist or being trained in any of that, but I don't have to be trained in that to know that if your emotions have become involved, what you've done is you have personalized something. You have now made this a matter of pride or embarrassment or shame or something. Emotions are neither good nor bad. They simply are. They just exist. We experience them. It doesn't matter. Making decisions based on emotions is bad and can be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
So in my research and reading, I just found this book from 1905 called The Crowd by a Frenchman, Gustave Le Bon, and he talks about the crowd being the single entity that best exhibits emotional decision-making. So I thought, well, if I can go through this and make this part of the construct to explain to people, if you're exhibiting these kinds of decisions or these kinds of processes, which is when a crowd forms, a psychological crowd forms and what they do,
right,
then you'll be catching yourself and identifying that misbehavior and trying not to be making emotional decisions. So that's the sort of Reader Digest version of what are the three things, and then sort of like the beginning bullet points that fall down underneath each one.
And the crowd sounds a lot like Mr. Market that Warren Buffett talks about, who comes into the office.
Yeah, and Jim Grant, too. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And what have you found among readers or people in general? Of course, you've had a lot of exposure to market participants, both when you've actively traded, but since the book came out. What have you found has been effective for people or distinguished people who have been able to develop and actually act on the information in the book? Because like you pointed out, I mean, I'm endlessly fascinated by this, even with my own books, whether it's business or sports or the 4-Hour Body, whatever it might be. There are some people who put the words into practice and there are others who fail to. And
right.
I'd love for you to comment on how or why the readers who are successful in doing that are successful, if you have any thoughts.
I have spoken to a number of people. A lot of people have contacted me over the years. It's been a long stretch. But I think what I found is, because what I try to do is just say, well, okay, here are the problems, but then, all right, now what to do about it?
Right.
And what I lay out in the back half of the book, or the back two chapters of the book, is, one, having a plan that is developed when you are not in the market. You cannot have a position on when you develop this thing.
Right.
And whatever your methodology is, you know, I mean, there's many ways to make money. There are participants. There are relatively few ways to lose it. I think I've just identified them. Form the checklist. Put that on the top half of a sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And on the bottom half of the sheet of paper, write out, because you have to have it objectified and down in black and white. Write down the if-then statements or scenarios under which you will pull the trigger to get in a position or get out of a position.
Right.
So that it is now out of your hands. Now, can you violate that? Can you take the piece of paper and throw it away or tear it up or whatever? Absolutely. But until somebody goes, I think, and puts down a checklist and has something to look at and say, am I doing one of these three things, or the little bullet points that fall under each one of those three?
Mm-hmm.
Am I succumbing to this, you know, and, you know, with the pencil start saying, okay, you know, and then are you following the bullet points that you now put at the bottom, which are the if-then scenarios under which you're going to act and pull the trigger on a position in the market? So I think the ones that have, you know, sort of gotten what I was saying, they have written it down. The top half of the sheet of paper is basically, you know, you print it out, right? I mean, and then the bottom half, your plan might not change from one day to the next, but some people print it out every day. Some people just print out the bottom half and say, okay, I'm changing the plan to do this. I'll check the checklist. Am I falling into these traps? Am I doing any of this stuff? And again, it's the propensity for humans to delude themselves and, you know, kind of cheat on that exists, and there's really not a lot, you know, I can do about that. But
right.
In terms of translating 65,000 words into a single sheet of paper that you can then try to instill it is the way that I found people abused it. And I did the same thing. I mean, I have a stack of legal pads, and I physically write the stuff out every day, because then it's not being tapped out on the computer. I literally have to write it out in, you know, capital letters with a pen, so that I know I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
And I do exactly the same thing, typically on a Post-it or an index card, something that's very physically limited in terms of real estate so that I can't have an unending, say, app full of to-do items. I feel like checklists are so undervalued, particularly when people feel that the decisions are simple enough to hold in their working memory, because the first thing, of course, that happens, like you said, you can't really formulate a plan when you have a position. And if you have an emotional response to a position, that working memory is going to be rendered useless.
Right. There's a reason why telephone numbers are 7 digits long, right? I mean, there is a capacity that the brain cannot take in. And this is actually going to be one of the sections of the book that I've already written it, but the book that I'm working on right now, which is basically concept formation. So If you, in your mind's eye, if I put up three vertical lines just on a piece of paper, one inch long, you can just glance at that and tell me there are three. Mm-hmm. You don't need to count them, right? Mm-hmm. Now, a five-year-old would have to count them because the five-year-old has not yet figured out how to grasp that much content at a glance and spit out what the answer is. Mm-hmm. But if I put 15 of those lines up there, right next to each other, You would have to count them. Right. Now, I could do a little shortcut, and I could do four of the lines vertical and then one diagonal through it, right? Mm-hmm. And you're old enough to know that means five. And I could put three of those, and you'd say, bang, 15. Mm-hmm. Or I could put the number 1, 5. And putting the digits 1 and 5 next to each other is condensing a lot of perceptual data into a smaller mental unit that you can grasp immediately. Mm-hmm. That's what your Post-it note is doing with the list, in my mind, and that's what my one-pager is doing in my mind, is that the bullet points are taking this, you know, mass of data that I have, you know, formed in my head, what am I going to do, what am I not going to do, and I'm boiling it down so that I can, at a glance, more readily apprehend it and put it to work.
Definitely. There's a very good writer, also a very good doctor, named Atul Gawande. I don't know if you've ever heard his name, but he's written for The New Yorker and wrote a book called The Checklist Manifesto. And it talked about how just incredibly profound the changes can be when a simple checklist is employed, for instance, for bacterial line infections or preventing bacterial line infections in hospitals. And of course, every doctor, every nurse feels like they don't need that type of assistance, but very simple mistakes with extreme consequences are made all the time in hospitals because people are rushed, there are extenuating circumstances, the unpredictable or the unexpected happens, and that's when the obvious becomes not so obvious or it gets lost in the noise.
Probably, you know, and I would imagine that pilots
exactly
are perfect examples of why they are maybe forced to do that. I don't know that much about it, but I mean,
no, that's a great example.
Checklist, right? Yeah.
Right. That's exactly right. And also effectively forcing the checklist to be used, because in the case of airlines, for instance, a lot of crashes when you review the black box tapes are caused by a reticence on the part of the co-pilot, who's oftentimes lower in the hierarchy than the actual primary pilot, of speaking up when he notices or she notices various problems or skipping of the checklist. And you could certainly see how that dynamic would play out if you have, let's say, a spouse who's nervous about a position or an employer who is somehow entered into the psychological dynamic. I want to come back to your current work and what you're working on. But before we get there, which investors have most impressed you or impress you? Whether that's, you know, the Jim Rogers types or others. I'd just be curious to hear which investors have most impressed you over time.
Well, again, my history is largely from the trading environment. I traded bonds, currencies, and commodities for, you know, 25 years and have only recently, in the last couple of years, kind of moved into the equities markets as part of my profession. And this is, you know, probably a, you know, shameless plug or whatever, but I work for the two smartest guys I've ever met in my life, so I feel very comfortable and happy there. In terms of the other investors, I do think that in my early years, I do think I learned a lot from speaking with Jim Rogers. You know, he said to me one time, he said, short soybeans and you'll learn more in 1 week than you will at 2 years at a business school.
Just by holding that position, regardless of the market.
Yeah, so I did. I by the end of the week, I did it for 5 days and I lost $450, but it was like the longest position I'd ever held. But you know what? I learned a lot. I was probably 24 years old and I really began to, and I was on my own. I wasn't employed. I was doing my own thing. I was trying to make money doing that. And I learned more in that, you know, doing that. I did learn a lot from, again, these are going to be floor traders, a guy named Tom Baldwin in the Bond Pit in Chicago. I learned a lot from reading about and interviews with these people. Bruce Kovner, he was featured in Market Wizards. And so, you know, again, my bent was really more on the speculator side, right? I wasn't an investor in that capacity or looking at equities that way. So I think that my perspective and approach are probably a little bit different from what most people maybe in the securities industry, you know, kind of grew up and cut their teeth on.
What impresses you about a good trader? What in your mind makes a good trader? Just out of curiosity, because I've never participated in the markets that way, but I've seen, for instance, bootleg copies of The Trader, which is about Paul Tudor Jones. And yeah, it can appear very sexy. It's very exciting. I'm sure a lot of people get swept into it that way. But what makes a good trader in your mind?
Well, I mean, I think actively being able to take a loss.
Mm-hmm.
You might be in a position and it's against you and you have a stop further down in the market to get you out if it gets down there. But the ability to just turn and just say, you know what, it's not acting right. I'm not going to mess with this. I'm not going to hope for it to go back up to kind of back to break even. I'm just going to go ahead and get out and be able to take that loss and just walk away from it and not relive it, not rehash it, not mull over it, not complain about it. And it's difficult because I think that what happens is, and I point this out in the book that the million-dollar book that we've been talking about, that because we lose points for wrong answers on tests in school, when we lose money, we must think that we were wrong, and we really don't like to be wrong. No matter what it is we're talking about, none of us likes to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to distinguish that and differentiate that and keep that money loss as an external thing rather than internalizing it, personalizing it, and equating loss with wrong and saying, no, I lost some money. This is not about being right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Running a business is not about being right or wrong. It's about making judicious risk management decisions in a condition of uncertainty, trying to speculate, and I mean that with a capital S, running a business, what future demand is going to be, where supply is going to come from, a very dispassionate view of the decision-making process, and to some extent, a healthy disrespect for money.
Mm-hmm.
Money is just a way of keeping score.
Mm.
It to become, you know, the be-all, end-all, that, I mean, that I've seen that get people into trouble. That wasn't the exact question you were asking. I've seen that get people into trouble, and I think some of the best traders I've seen, like, the money is not, you know, what it's about. It's not what they're doing. They're not flashy. They're not going out and, you know, buying crazy things. And
well, I've heard, maybe you can confirm or deny this, but I've heard from a number of people that there are, it may not be hedge fund managers specifically, but traders who are playing with huge positions, who at numerous points in their careers, when they reach a height of anxiety, when they're having panic attacks and are unable to sleep and so on, that their rule is to liquidate all of their positions and start from scratch, which would seem to sort of reinforce the keeping track perspective of capital in this particular case. I think I may have read that in a book called More Money Than God about a number of the sort of titans of the hedge fund industry. But that's something that I've struggled with, quite frankly, because oddly enough, in the highly speculative startup market where I've been very fortunate to be involved with, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, Uber, Evernote, a lot of these companies, it's binary. Once I make a decision,
you're in an illiquid situation.
Exactly. For the most part, you're in an illiquid situation. So I have to do all my due diligence, my homework, cross my fingers and place a bet. And then I am not asked by Mr. Market every morning, do you want to buy? Do you want to sell? Do you want to buy? Do you want to sell?
Right. And you're an investor. And you're an investor of the longest time frame that Adam Smith was talking about when he scripted that out, because the idea of you waiting for a dividend, whether that comes from, you know, going public or whatever, is a really long time. But no, you're right. And I think that it is. I mean, you're an investor, and a lot of what I've been talking about, a lot of what the book is about in the specifics of the parable is speculators. But even investors in the liquid securities markets do have the ability to decide, I do not want to be in the steel market anymore. I was in the steel business today. I don't want to be in there by Thursday, and I'm going to get out.
Right.
So it's a contrast. And I've heard anecdotally about people liquidating all the way down to zero. But really, I've heard and I've experienced myself just, you know, liquidating down to the sleep level. So here's a great analogy.
Yeah.
There's a guy who I worked with at the investment bank in Nashville. He's long since dead now, but he was around when the firm started in 1927. So he went through the crash and the depression working for that firm and was still there in the mid-1980s when I got there, May 13th, 1985. He said, Brendan, there are only two positions in the market. and it's not long and short. And I kind of looked at him. He said, it's too little and too much. So when it's working for you, when the position's going your way, you don't have enough on. And when it's going against you, you got too much on. So, well, I liquidate down to a sleep level. Yeah, I've done that. I've done that a number of times. If I've gotten completely out when I'm just like, it's not going, something's wrong. I don't understand what's happening here. The volatility is too much or whatever. And I've heard this one as well. I mean, these are little, you know, cliches that come from the street. But, you know, it's better to be a coward and live to fight another day than to die on the battlefield. And
right.
Jim was killing himself on the battlefield by losing that much money in that short period of time. And so, some, you know, but that's it. A trader will take the lump and just say, okay, so I lost the money, but I have to stay liquid so I can come back and, you know, try this again if I think I have any skill at doing this. I can't make this a matter of being right or wrong and risk all the capital just because there's room to risk it.
You know, one of the things I really loved about what I learned losing $1 million, which helped me tremendously, was looking at my internal state, my internal rules, the beliefs, behaviors, emotions, as forensically as possible, as objectively as possible, to set rules in advance that would serve me so that I wouldn't misbehave and make sort of capricious impulse decisions that would be extremely harmful. And one of the things that sparked in my mind, at least, was trying to diagnose those various aspects of your psychology so that you could identify the type of investing that you are best suited to. And in my case, I realized that, and this happened after reading Lowenstein's The Making of an American Capitalist about Warren Buffett, where there's a story in that book that roughly, and I'm paraphrasing this and I might have sort of exaggerated it in my own mind, but Warren Buffett used to come home and then walk up to his office and continue reading annual reports. And at one point his son had fallen down the stairs and was like sprawled out on the staircase with some type of injury. And he came home, kind of looked at his son oddly, stepped over him and walked up to his office and then came down a few minutes later and asked him if he was okay. And that to me just seemed perfectly appropriate for him because he is the Tiger Woods of emotional detachment from his investments. And it just struck me that perhaps just like being able to jump from the foul line and slam dunk a basketball, that there are people who have these predispositions to be able to do things like that. And I think that you can certainly develop a lot of those skill sets. But for me, I realized that playing in a binary game, namely startups in this case, and there are exceptions and you can sell or buy on the secondary and there are fancy things you can do. But in very simple terms, preventing myself from looking at charts was a very, very good idea. It really opened my eyes when reading about, obviously, the parables and the stories related to Jim and then your analysis and dissection of sort of theoretically and practically how you put that into the real world. What are your favorite other books on investing? If you had to pick, say, 1 to 3 books, if you're like, all right, if you're only going to read 1 book, 2 book, or 3 books on investing besides this one that I'm looking at right in front of me, what would you
say? That's got to be number one on the list.
Got to be number one. So what would the others be? And they don't necessarily have to be books that would be described as on investing.
Right. Well, I mean, I think 2 books kind of fashioned and got me interested in this at a very early age. The first book I read on the markets was a book called The Money Game by the pen name Adam Smith. His name is George Goodman. It was probably written in 1967. It just happened to be on my parents' bookcase a long time ago, and I was probably, you know, 15 or 16 years old when I read that. And, you know, then I went to college and kind of, you know, I was studying finance, so I was sort of already in the industry and kind of getting going. Then I came across another book called Once in Golconda. It's about the bull market of 1960s.
Absolutely. I've seen this. Yeah. I've seen this book. Actually, a friend sent it to me as a gift.
Just in terms of the cycles of the markets and the economy, it has a broad scope. And so, you know, some of these things have happened before or in similar ways. They're not all identical, but to try to get some history and perspective that way. And then I've already mentioned the other one, you know, which is The Crowd by Laban. I think that it's a fascinating book for, he looks at how groups of people can get caught up in these mass manias and panics. But what I observed was that those same traits can be exhibited, manifested in an individual, in a decision-making process, in an environment of uncertainty, whether you're in an office with people around you or whether you're sitting I work in an office by myself and got a home office, so there's no one around, but looking at screens and being inundated with information and news or whatever, that an individual can exhibit those same traits and characteristics that make a group of people lose their individual sense of self-preservation. And, for example, after your team loses a sports event, you go out with a whole bunch of people and you set the town on fire, right? And you're like, really? I mean, you would never do that on your own, but in the group it happens. And so they take actions that are obviously contrary to their individual interests, but they do it because they are swept up in this mania or panic. Mm-hmm. And I think an individual can do that, particularly with decisions about money, particularly about in liquid markets where you're getting constant feedback. Like you said, you wake up every morning and you're not getting a check from Mr. Market on what those prices are. Or I mean, I don't mean a check. I mean checking the price or getting a reading on what those prices are. Whereas, you know, I'm getting thousands of price changes a day by looking at screens, and it's like, you know, it's easy for somebody to fall into that. And I think that that book does a really good job of providing the macro view of what a micro can affect an individual.
Mm-hmm. And I want to be, of course, cognizant of your time. But before we wrap up, I would love to hear you elaborate on what you're currently working on, whether that's the new book or other subject matter, because I know we talked a bit before we recorded about the subject matter, and I found it extremely fascinating.
Okay. Well, so I'm working on two. One I've had to indefinitely shelve just because I'm too busy with primary work and things, but I'm writing a book on grammar. I'm assuming you do not want to hear about that.
The other one.
So I'm writing a book. The working title is, you know, Fooled by Similarity, The Art of Risk, or The Art of Risk Management. And it's a look at how thousands of years ago, you know, societies, whether they were tribes or clans or, you know, whatever, they looked out for each other. So if, you know, one guy's crop failed or got eaten by animals or whatever, they all would take the numerator, the denominator, and divide the loss and keep that family alive so that nothing bad would happen to them, right? So it was a pretty easy pooling of risk that took place. And, you know, as time marched on, you get into around the 1600s, 1660, basically you got the early stages of understanding the science and the math of probability. And this came about because a different kind of risk. You know, most risk prior to that was all seen as downside. If something bad happens, that's risk. It's going to go down, right? Mm-hmm. But when they started doing this with games of chance, you now had a man-made environment where something good could happen or something bad could happen. Mm-hmm. And so the development of probability in that was an exercise in math, and mm-hmm. it was purely predictive. It is purely predictive. I don't have to take a deck of 52 cards and go through all the different combinations and permutations to find out that there are 2,598,980 different five-card poker hands, right? Mm-hmm. The math will tell me what it is, and it will tell me what the likelihood is of getting any one of those hands or going into the future. Mm-hmm. A numerator and a denominator, fine. Fast forward 140 years. In 1880s, you start getting the development of statistics, which I think got fooled by the similarity of there being a numerator and a denominator. And they started saying, well, you know, something happened in the past. There seemed to be like X number of fires in the city about every year. And so they start taking data from the past, numerator and denominator, examined outcome versus possible outcomes, and said, well, you know, it's happened that many times in the past. Therefore, it's a probability that will happen in the future. And that's where I think the problem breaks down.
Right.
Is that with probability, you've got class probability. You have a uniquely defined set of population of possible outcomes, and they form a class. Mm-hmm. With statistics, you have cases, and the word case is French, and it actually is the root for the word chance in English. So these are all chances, and actually that's a funny story, but I'm just a sidebar, that in finance, particularly in investment, you know, business, in the 50s, as it became very scientific with Markowitz and the paper that he wrote and modern portfolio theory and so on, in the 40s, as they were trying to kind of go through this stuff, two guys were doing work on modern stochastic analysis, and they couldn't figure out whether they wanted to call it a chance variable or a random variable. The word random had popped in because of random Brownian motion with Einstein in 1905, and everybody was trying to, you know, it makes finance and economics sound scientific if you start using words from the physical sciences.
Right.
So they were trying to settle on, should we use chance variable or random variable? And you know how they settled it?
How'd they do that?
They flipped a coin.
That's very appropriate.
So they wound up with, you know, random variable. My point is that in the social sciences, you have case probability. You do not have class probability. I don't understand why baseball players have a single batting average. Shouldn't they have one for every pitcher that they face? Should I have a daytime one and a nighttime one? What are the odds of me getting struck by lightning? Somebody can tell me, but I would say, well, using statistics, the odds are none because so far I've never gotten hit by lightning. Therefore, there's a 100% chance that I will not get hit by lightning. So there is some confusion.
Well, it's like the turkey. It's like the turkey in the Black Swan.
He gets fed every day. That's right. That's right.
Before Thanksgiving, exactly.
That's right. That's right. Unless he's the White House turkey, you know, because he gets pardoned. So I think that people are fooled by the similarities between, but similarity is not sameness. You do, it is not the same thing to do statistical analysis and then try to fast forward that in the future and say, probabilistically, this is going to happen. So I have reams of examples, and I won't load the book with it. I'll just do enough to kind of get the point across, where here's a market phenomenon that has worked 100% in the past. It's happened X number of times, and 100% of the time, it has been profitable the next week, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But then, if you fast forward that through time, you see it break down and it stops working. And now there's a whole new population that it's dealing with. That is not a deck of cards. That is not a roulette wheel where probability, class probability exists. You're dealing with case probability, and these things are indeterminate. You do not have the prescribed possible universe of outcomes. And I think people, again, get a false sense of security by putting the math to it because there's a numerator denominator like there is in probability, and they think that they actually have quote-unquote odds in their favor, as though they could repeat that thing, that experiment, 100 times in a laboratory. They can't.
Right.
They can't. You can't replicate that social science phenomenon in a lab the way you can with the cards, the roulette wheel, or whatever, in the game's chance.
Which is also an issue in mass media where you see journalism, or say journalists, not all, but many, who misinterpret, say, observational scientific data and conflate it with experimental data where you can actually isolate variables and look at cause and effect. But they take correlation and turn it into causal data. And it creates mass hysteria, which then gets put into Wikipedia because it's cited from Magazine X, and it can become a huge disaster for public perception that can lead to things like dietary habits over the last several decades, which contradict, or I should say, are contradicted by a lot of the supporting data. So yeah, this is all extremely fascinating and I think extremely actionable when people are able to digest it in the right format, in the right context. And like you said, I think stories and examples are extremely helpful in those cases. To shift gears, I have two more questions for you. Do you read fiction? Do you read any fiction books? You do not? Okay.
The last piece of fiction I read was Atlas Shrugged, and I finished it on October 18th, 1987.
Okay. That's a perfect
job. The
day
before the stock market crashed, because I came back from my honeymoon the day the stock market crashed, and I got fired from my job.
Oh, wow.
Because the guy thought it was the end of the world, so he fired us all and closed the business.
Oh, man.
I came home and I said, honey, I'm home. And I mean, I'm really home. I ain't going anywhere. I got nowhere to go.
Why don't you read fiction? Why haven't you read fiction after that point? I'm just curious. I'm not saying you should or you shouldn't.
I just like facts and figures, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I don't care about stories. I guess I watched Pretty Woman with Jim.
Do you not watch movies either?
No. Well, I don't have a TV. I know I went to movies with my kids when they were young, like we go family, and it was like a Disney movie, like The Lion King or something, which, I mean, I don't think that was intended for me.
No, that makes perfect sense. Last question. If you were to sort of rewind the clock, or if you were able to give your 18-year-old self or 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say wait a little bit later to make most of the major life decisions. I think I was probably a little too young when I made a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
So probably just wait, just get a little bit more maturity before pulling the trigger. So my father died when I was in college. So there wasn't really anybody like saying, oh, you might want to hold off on that a little bit. You might want to think about doing this. I was just basically out of my own kind of doing whatever I thought was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was probably a little bit too young and immature for making some of the decisions I made. But
what types of decisions?
I did most of the major life decisions, I think, in terms of, you know, moving city, how long do you stay at a job, when you get married, when you have kids, when you buy a house. I mean, I think that some of those could have gone on a little bit longer, and I was probably a little bit quick to pull the trigger.
Got it. Well, let's wrap this up here, and perhaps sometime we can have a part two. But this has been great fun. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
Okay, good.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Tim. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.
Awesome. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.